From the Roots Up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I am Phil Taylor, your host. And, well, today is a type of holiday, and they're not quite sure what to call it, a civic holiday, they say. It, of course, was, I think it's still regarded semi-officially as Simcoe Day. We all want to remember John Simcoe, Upper Canada, first governor. But actually, one of the reasons we're probably not making a big deal of it is, I hope one of the reasons we're not making a big deal of his name is not only, of course, that he came to rule over Indigenous people and impose the matters on them, but that his last big assignment was to go to Haiti and to put down a leader named Toussaint. He was assigned by the British to protect the slave plantations of French royalists. And you probably know he failed. But many, many thousands lost their lives in that. And I don't know why that there isn't more discussion that that was his last big job. And he was so bad at it that the Duke of Wellington, the Iron Duke, said that he ought to actually be tried, he ought to be court-martialed, because what he did was, I think he's decided he had stomach flu, and he went home after he was beaten by Toussaint's forces. But they were, this is a little historical matter that we, since they have these holidays because they want us to remember historical matters, the historical matter was that they were attempting to sustain the slave system in Haiti. That's a little known fact, because later, of course, the roles were reversed between the French and British rulers. But at that time, since there was a slave revolt going on, it was thought by the British that they should try to protect the royalists of France, and the royalists, of course, who owned plantations and had slaves in Haiti. Again, he was defeated. So this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. So we're celebrating the defeat of Simcoe at Haiti, as all other Canadians are. That's why we're out there with the pom-poms and et cetera. we'll be talking probably about 20 after the hour with Tony Leah, Unifor, because there's big developments in the labor movement on really important matters. Speaking out, as they rarely do, certainly with any voice, with any noise or strength, they usually sort of speak under their breath on international matters, political affairs, but they have something to say now on the matter of Gaza and Palestine. Tony's the author of The Truth About the 1937 Oshawa GM Strike. With the subtitle, They Made Cars and They Made Plans. Reds, the Rank and File and International Solidarity Unionized GM. And it's Baraka Books. You should get a copy of it. Everybody should have that. We have to know our history. And so here's a part of history. There's items that will not be or are not adequately reported. And to my mind, this is a big one. The Canadian Labour Congress has issued a statement, and it says, Trade and International Affairs, Canada's unions applaud recognition of Palestinian statehood and urge further action to end the crisis in Gaza. This was released on the 31st of July, and it's an open letter from Bea Brusque, the president of the Canadian Labour Congress, addressed to Prime Minister Mark Carney. And it says, Dear Prime Minister, on behalf of Canadian unions, I am writing about the unspeakable situation in Gaza and what can be described as genocide. The October 7 terrorist attack by Hamas was an atrocity. The collective punishment being inflicted on millions of Palestinians in response is a crime of historic scale. In June, Canada's unions called on your government to take several actions to address the horror and what is unfolding in Gaza, the first of which was recognizing Palestinian statehood. On behalf of the Canadian Labour Congress and the more than 3 million workers we represent, I want to commend you for your recent announcement that Canada will recognize Palestinian statehood. Recognizing Palestine cannot be a reward at the end of negotiations. It is a precondition to the start of a real peace process. In the face of immense human suffering, it is important to see Canada recommit itself to the principles of international law, human dignity, and peace. Recognition of Palestinian statehood is a critical first step, but it alone will not stop the suffering in Gaza. Nearly 22 months into this war, more than 60,000 Palestinian people are dead, including more than 15,000 children. The 2.1 million Palestinians in Gaza face starvation and indiscriminate bombardment. 3 million more in the West Bank suffer daily humiliation, violence, and a systemic campaign of land confiscation and settlement expansion. Canada must take further steps to build on the recognition of Palestinian statehood to end the suffering in Gaza and bring a peaceful resolution. Canada's unions outlined 3 steps in our June letter. Finally, Canada must work to strengthen democracy to deliver peace now. Hamas will not be defeated by Netanyahu. Hamas will be defeated by the Palestinian people if they have hope for a free and peaceful future with decent jobs and social and economic equality, security, pardon me. Palestinians need autonomy. They need rights. They need recognition. Israel rightly demands security guarantees, and that demand must be met. But peace cannot be built on subjugation. I also share this open letter from Luc Triangle, the General Secretary of the International Trade Union Confederation, ITUC, released earlier this week. The ITUC is the global voice of working people and includes both Israel's Histadrut and the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions among its affiliates. The CLC is a member of the ITUC and supports the calls to action in this letter. Prime Minister, Canada has an opportunity and a responsibility to be a force for peace. Thank you for your commitment to recognizing Palestinian statehood. There are those who will seek to weaken the growing international consensus that the horror of what is occurring in Gaza must stop. It is important to remain resolute in the face of that pressure. Our commitment to diplomacy, international law, and human rights must guide our actions toward a just and lasting resolution. That is from the Canadian Labour Congress. No, I didn't think I'd ever be reading that, did I? No, it's quite important. The details we could all quibble about, but the basic point is absolutely true. And it is quite a remarkable moment in our history that the Canadian Labour Congress, as I mentioned earlier, has found its voice, as have other labour bodies, and we'll be talking with Tony Leah about that. Of course, I bring this to your attention because I don't see congratulations or op-ed pieces written in our major media about it. They may have noted it, but by the way, it was a very informed statement. It was not, I wouldn't call that boilerplate. If somebody has made a significant decision. It's interesting because, of course, on the labor front, we have the issue of a hegemony over Canada by the United States, but also by the AFL-CIO in the U.S. I'm not aware that they have said anything. They are among the worst cold warriors and warmongers in American politics. They have been beaten into submission by the the elite, the capitalist elite of America, and they've long since become just a pawn. And usually they're able to exercise a control over the hegemonic influence over the Canadian Labour Congress. At least historically, that's been a problem. I don't know whether this would represent anything, what its impact will be for that relationship. Let's hope it would lead to a friendly quarrel, because it's like the matter of tariffs. Unions have been kind of staggering to figure out how to address it and not abandon common solidarity, working class solidarity across borders. That's historically one of the biggest headaches of the labor movement, the biggest headaches of the socialist movements. So at any rate, I'm really glad they made that statement. We'll be talking, as I say, to Tony Leah about other movements and what they had to say. On the matter of recognition, I think it's very important to point out that it is actually a rather empty gesture in some respects, because it was done in a consensus way with France and the UK, neither of which have distinguished themselves in solidarity or protection with the people of Palestine, with the protection of them from the attacks in Gaza, which are going on as we speak. For reasons known to those parties, they had political agreement among them, and when they do that, principle is not involved, actually. They're deciding on how to maneuver as states. And in the case of the UK, it was really embarrassing that Starmer, the so-called Labour leader, who now, by the way, is very dramatically going to be challenged by Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn is forming a new party and already, in a matter of days, has signed up 500,000 members of his new political movement, which is, if I was Mr. Starmer, I would be very worried. But to go back, Starmer's position basically was cheap. It was embarrassing because he said, I'm going to recognize the Palestinian state in September unless you change what you're doing in Gaza. Well, what you're hearing then is, and I'm really glad in some way that he said it, because this is the basic fundamental problem. The concept that the Canadian government operates from, the British government operates from, the French, particularly, I would say the French, study what happened in Algeria. They have the old monarch's idea that we are their subjects, and they will give us this, or they will take it away. They might do something, but it's them. And in fact, Palestine And any other developing country, those who struggle against colonialism, those who struggle for the right to self-determination, do not have to ask permission. And they don't have to meet some criteria that is established by the monarchists. After all things are done in the name of His Highness, King Charles. They do not have to toe any, the line of the UK. And there was the same patronizing and racial problem in the statement coming from the prime minister. But by the way, this is so ingrained in our culture that he found it necessary to say all these foolish things that, of course, he said that Hamas could not be part of any government, and also that the various that the borders had to be this, and had a bunch of criteria for recognition. But you know, recognition began in 1948. The decision was made. The reason states continually say two-state solution is that that's what they voted on. You know, people often say, "Well, we got to throw that out the window." You know, we don't want a two-state; we want a one, whatever. And I understand that, but the states that we're talking about took a decision, and so they're representing their nations. So when those nations voted and decided that there would be a two-state solution, that was 1948, and it was guaranteed by two really important individuals, Harry Truman of the United States and Joseph Stalin of Russia, are the ones who made the decision that there would be two states. It doesn't mean that that's how it's going to work out, but that was the agreed position. And so the Palestinian rights have been there from that time in terms of international agreements. And I would remind the prime minister that when you say, oh, Hamas cannot take part, they won't be part of any future government. In 1948, there was a man who was a leader of the Irgun, an armed group in Palestine, Mandate Palestine, Menachem Begin, and he was regarded as an assassin and a murderer and a terrorist by the British, because, and I would look, just tell you, look it up, many, many British soldiers died at the hands of that group. So they regarded him as a murderer and as a terrorist. And he was, even after Israel was given recognition by the UK and the Americans, he remained on a wanted list. So you can't impose that. The Palestinians' right to a state is already settled. And when Canada, you know, acts like in his royal way, oh, now we deign to look upon you as someone who might have a state, that's a job nobody gave you. They already have the right to have a state, long since have had the right. And the great overwhelming majority of states recognize the Palestinian state. And what the parameters of an agreement might be cannot be imposed by NATO states. They think it can, and I don't deny that they are blasting and digging and murdering throughout the region to make sure they always have what they want. Libya is gone, Syria is gone, Iraq was destroyed. And they have greater plans to, they're going to rip up Lebanon, that's rather obvious. But on the question of Palestinians and their rights, that doesn't leave. So long as you have international law and you have a UN charter, whatnot, the matter is already settled. And so we really shouldn't have the situation where the prime minister basically is saying, oh, yes, we'll recognize you as a state provided you don't have the right of return, you don't have the right to have an army, which would mean no self-defense for you, And you would, and you have to wear an ankle bracelet and report to a human rights leader once a week. That's a joke. But I agree with the Canadian Labour Congress statement that, look, you're simply making it clear that the key issue is addressed. What the impact is going to be is really much harder to work out. Because, frankly, you know, it's a proverb: if you're going to have a meal with the devil, you better use a long spoon. And the British and the French created this crisis through their colonial policies. And when they say that they want to help out, they should go to the back of the line for helping out. And as we say on the Taylor Report often, any agreement has to, in order to be credible and have any hope, it has to be between the major parties, Russia, China, the U.S., yes, and Britain and France, others. They have to say, we are agreeing to do this. Because so if you do it through the office of Trump, who, you know, and you say that we're going to, or through the U.S. or through Paris, you're just asking for more trouble. And that's the element that we'd like to see everybody recognize and change, which gives me a chance to say something quickly also about NATO. We're now having election fever developing for the new leader of the NDP, and others are talking about it. You know, Canadian policy, and NATO should be removed as central to Canada's political posture in the world. It seems to me we ought to emphasize something, that there is a war, a horrible one, in terms of damage and loss of life in Ukraine. And this was initiated primarily by NATO states, who began to talk about how Ukraine may or possibly or should become part of NATO. Canada's part of that. I know that NATO itself shouldn't be there for Canada. It's not necessary. The NDP used to be formally against it. I don't know what their current position is, but you certainly don't hear anything from their leaders about it. But if they are part of NATO meetings, they ought to be voting along with Hungary, Slovakia, and some others, saying, no, let's drop this whole subject of Ukraine, NATO, because that is why we're having a war. If you were to say, no, it's clear, we're for a neutral Ukraine, then the war fever would disappear. But so long as you have that, you're going to have fever and you're going to have more dangerous situation. As we know, over the weekend, Trump decided to move nuclear submarines around so that the world could see him doing his Hulk Hogan routine. And all that is related to the violent problem of Ukraine. So Canada, yes, like Mexico, we shouldn't be part of NATO, but you'd have to be a real grown-up country to even think about that. Though today, we're told our ministers, a couple of major figures in the Canadian government are going to Mexico this week to meet with the president of Mexico. And I think they should ask her, explain how we could get ourselves into your situation where Mexico does not want to be under Donald Trump's golden dome. I assume that the golden part refers to his hair. They are not under it. He never offered it to them, and they don't want to be. But Canada has already said it wants to be, while the tariffs are tearing us up. And so we might ask some advice from the president of Mexico. and they're not under the Golden Dome, and they are not a member of NATO, and I'm very confident that nobody asked them to be part of NATO. And part of, I'll tell you what, that is traceable to, partly, they speak Spanish, they are called a Catholic, largely Catholic country, and these are disqualifying problems. It causes the snooty elements who run NATO to say, well, these are not our sort of people. If, for example, most people think Mexico and South America, Mexico is North America. So we're in a position to wake up a little bit, and probably these crises are causing us to, whether we want to be woke up or not. Lastly, I want to mention, I started today by reading the statement from the Canadian Labour Congress. I congratulate them that they are moving and speaking. And I hope that this will have impact, particularly on Canadian workers who tend not to be heard from or to be ignored. So that's a great development, and the media will not be reporting this the way we are reporting it. I think, for example, every newspaper ought to carry, every internet paper, whatever, I call them papers, should carry the statement because it's important. It's coming from the Canadian Labour Congress. There's also really important actions that have been taken by important and significant Canadian leaders, which for some reason, that while they are famous or they're revered in many quarters, suddenly the media is not interested in their opinions. And I want to mention Stephen Lewis again, because Stephen Lewis attended the regular Thursday 8 a.m. Victoria Park Road and Kingston Road vigil that has been there just as witness and calling for an end to the attacks on Gaza and calling for the proper delivery of food under the appropriate bodies, the United Nations bodies, not American private firm with guns. And Stephen Lewis attended really as simply a political gesture to say, I'm in solidarity with this position. And the Canadian media, I checked, I haven't seen any report of it. Now, he was the former ambassador, Canadian ambassador to the United Nations. He was certainly one of the most eloquent and visible leaders of the New Democratic Party when it was went through, really had considerable success, and his words were considered important to report. So a former United Nations ambassador of Canada takes this step at a time when he's not in the best of health, and our major media, like trained dogs, know not to bark, not to say anything, because, frankly, let's be honest, if Stephen's appearance at a peace vigil, 8 a.m. Thursdays, Kingston Road and Victoria Park, if that were properly reported and his views, reporters were to seek him out and get his views, it would have impact. And so people who control the major media decided they don't want that to happen. So we don't have papers. Media has us, and which is why we discuss it on the Taylor Report. And by the way, I take my hat off to Stephen Lewis for doing this. Incidentally, one of the principal reasons it's also noteworthy is that he had remained for many years silent on the subject, and it was troubling, frankly, to many people. They wanted to know, what does Stephen think? And I'm sure he was going through quite a soul-searching. That's, again, anybody with, as they say, a nose for news would realize this is a story that ought to be done. It'd make a good pamphlet, make a good book, because he's a major figure in Canadian political history. Well, enough of that for the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I think we're going to have a musical break, and we'll be back, and we will talk to Tony Leo about this remarkable turn in the labor movement.